Is this a global slowdown?
Or a global overreaction?
From APM, American Public Media in New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm David Brancaccio. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Monday, June the 4th.
Coming up, new ideas to bring calm to Europe.
Private highways versus federal funding in the U.S.
And American Apparel, when the name doesn't say it all.
Just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
We came into the trading day with Europe lower, Japanese stock prices at a 28-year low, and a pile of headlines about the possibility of a global economic slowdown. Marketplace's David Gura has been looking into all of this. David, good morning.
Morning, Jeremy.
Well, tell us what else is at play here.
Well, obviously, Europe, there's still a lot of concern about what's happening there and what's going to happen there with Greece, of course, the old standby. But we're hearing a lot more about financial worries in countries like Portugal and Spain. Spain is a big deal because its economy is so big. And today, Portugal announced it's going to draw more money from international lenders to keep its economy afloat. But the European stuff, Jeremy, that's been going on in the background for a long time now, as you know. I think what's really starting to scare investors is bad news from the so-called emerging markets. Economic growth appears to be slowing in China. Manufacturing grew at its weakest pace there since last year. And now we're starting to see the same kind of slowdown in India and Brazil.
But we've known about a lot of this stuff for a while. So I guess the question is, do we have a fundamental problem here that people just woke up to on Friday, or are the markets doing a little overreaction here?
So you talk to investors, you always need to translate. When investors say short term, they mean quick reactions to market news. Bruce McCain, the chief investment strategist at Key Private Bank, says that in this case, we should be looking at the long term, and that's the deeper fundamentals of the economy.
It's now looks worse than it probably is from the longer term standpoint, but it's still that sluggish, anemic growth cycle that we've been battling over the course of this entire recovery.
And fueling that, of course, is economic uncertainty all over the world. And with investors, Jeremy, you need a translation, and you also need to know that if there's one thing they hate, it's uncertainty.
Indeed. Marketplace's David Gura in Washington. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Jeremy.
It used to be a pipe dream of some senior European officials just a year ago. Now German Chancellor Angela Merkel is pushing for a central authority to regulate all the finances of countries that use the euro. Douglas Redeker, senior fellow at the New America Foundation, argues that the latest chapter of the euro crisis is bringing life to all sorts of previously impossible policy options. Mr. Redeker, good morning.
Good morning.
So among the possibilities are an actual budget union. That's going to be a little hard to swallow in the individual countries, taking orders from a central authority, but this may be what Europe has come to.
Well, I'm not sure it's going to end up there, at least not in the interim step. I think what you're more likely to see is a centralized budgetary overseer in Brussels or elsewhere. And what I mean by that is not that there'll be one entity sitting in Brussels that will dictate what budgets will be, but rather that budgets at the national level will simply be run by this central ministry for approval, meeting certain guidelines.
Any other interesting thinking in the face of this crisis these days?
One of the major stress points in Europe right now is obviously the banking system, both in Spain and elsewhere. And I think that you're seeing increasing talk about a central banking regulator and a central banking deposit guarantee scheme, similar to some degree to what we have in the U.S. and the FDIC, but they don't have that in Europe. And the other side is there are a lot of different iterations out there for some sort of euro bonds. And one of the major issues is that they have a huge accumulated stock of debt. And there are some conversations taking place about bonds that would actually work towards paying down that debt over 10, 20 years, as well as financing ongoing budgets. And some of them are quite creative, actually.
Douglas Redeker, New America Foundation, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks, David.
Today, three big banks in Portugal were forced to draw on an $8.25 billion worth of European Union bailout money to weather the current financial storm. Portugal has been slogging through very tight budgets in order to be eligible for money like this. Paulo Cazaca is an economist and former politician in Portugal. He joins us now from Brussels. Mr. Cazaca, good morning.
Good morning.
Help me understand what happened with the banks today. Should we take this as a sign that the banks in Portugal are weak, or should we take this as a sign that Portugal is doing what's necessary so that it can, when necessary, draw on the bailout money?
Well, I think it certainly means that the banks are weak, otherwise they would not need to make these measures. And it means as well that the Portuguese debt is growing to keep the banks afloat. If it's going to work or not, it's really very difficult to answer, because I think to a very large extent it will depend on the European environment.
Help me understand why the Portuguese banks are drawing on that money now.
The phenomena is not only a Portuguese one, it's a European one. We are seeing all the signs of what we can call a recession spiral, where people try to make the ends meet by cutting deficits. And this deficit cutting is putting everyone in a more difficult position. Most of the people are very skeptical, and I myself remain very skeptical on the capacity of this program to sort out the Portuguese problems.
Paulo Casaca is now a consultant in Belgium. Mr. Casaca, thank you very much for this.
It was a pleasure speaking to you.
There were also reports today that China is looking at strategies for dealing with the possibility that Greece might have to abandon the euro. The European uncertainty comes at a time that factories in China may already be slowing down. Economists don't like to see that because, among other things, if Chinese manufacturers are making less, it means Western consumers are buying less. Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz is with us now from Shanghai. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Jeremy.
So, Rob, when we hear about a slowdown in manufacturing in China, how serious are we talking about at this point?
Well, you know, I can tell you a specific story of the slowdown from my flight from the United States this past weekend. And my seatmate was this gentleman who manages a factory outside of Shanghai. His company makes air compressors, and he exports most of them to the EU and the US. But, of course, both those markets are drying up. So, you know, he told me he's had to lay off 10% of his workforce this year. But when I asked him where he was flying from, he tells me Brazil. He had just spent a couple weeks there, and boy, he was sure happy. He had found a bunch of new clients there, and he was just really happy to have found a country that had some money to buy his products.
So maybe some hope for the global economy coming from South America at the moment. And Rob, let me ask you about something else. Stocks have been dropping around the world too, and I want to ask you about what happened today in Shanghai. The Shanghai Composite Index closed at a very, shall we say, interesting number.
Yeah, the Shanghai Composite Index fell 64.89 points today. You know, if you separate those digits out, it's 6489, the date of the government's brutal crackdown on student protesters in Beijing. And today happens to be the 23rd anniversary of that event. So I kid you not, the term Shanghai Composite Index is blocked on search engines in China as a result, because so many people have been on Twitter. They've been on the Chinese microblogging service Weibo on this. And so the government has already cracked down on that search engine term.
Marketplace China correspondent Rob Schmitz in Shanghai. Thanks, Rob.
Thanks, Jeremy.
All right. Well, we've heard about the U.S. We've heard about Europe. We've heard about China. Let's put it all together now with Julia Coronado. She's chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas, and she's with us as she is every Monday. Good morning, Julia.
Good morning.
So, Julia, let's start with some of the problems in the global economy that are causing so many jitters in markets around the world. The United States, we found out on Friday, of course, that just 69,000 jobs were added to the U.S. economy last month. Does that change the dynamic as far as what we think about the U.S. economy right now?
Well, I think with the U.S., we need to be careful about interpreting the data that way. We knew that a record warm winter had pulled forward some hiring into the winter months at the expense of spring. Now we're seeing those weak numbers materialize. I think if we look through those numbers, the picture is, you know, the U.S. economy is not in fantastic shape, but it's still kind of muddling along.
What about China? A lot of worries about a slowdown in manufacturing there.
Right. The Chinese data have been consistently weaker than expected over the last few months. And I think both with China and other emerging markets, the worry is that we're sort of reaching the limits of expansion. These countries have been booming over the last few years, and it just may be that we're reaching the limits of that growth in some areas.
All right. Well, what about Europe? We've talked a lot about that with you. Lots of worries about whether the euro can stay together.
Oh, yes. And we will worry. We will worry on and on and on. There is no rabbit to pull out of the hat here. This is going to be a difficult circumstance. The recession is deepening, making the choices that much harder. But ultimately, these countries have to decide whether they want to hang together and tough it out or break apart. And neither scenario is easy.
Finally, Julia, let me just ask you about oil prices. I mentioned they're down to $82 a barrel. Is that something that could provide a sort of stimulative effect?
Yeah, I mean, this is a factor that helps cushion the blow of some of the bad news. We are going to see falling gasoline prices in the coming months, and we're going to see record low interest rates. And on the other hand, we have less support from the global economy. We have lower stock prices, but net-net, we're probably, again, still in the muddle-through territory for the U.S.
Julia Coronado, chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas, thanks as always.
It's a pleasure.
The biggest wildfire ever recorded in New Mexico is still growing. The Forest Service has spent $1.4 billion fighting fires last year. This year, the bill could be higher. Laura Morales reports from KJZZ in Flagstaff.
Forest ecologist Wally Covington says for a long time, fire was seen as the enemy, and that allowed forests to grow thick.
You can't buy enough fire equipment. You can't hire enough firefighters when you have the landscape so loaded with fuel as we've got it today.
Fire managers think about things like air pollution, water supply, and saving homes when calculating the risks of fighting a blaze. Tom Harbor is the Forest Service director. He says there's an art and science to making these tough decisions.
Sometimes the accumulation of those decisions will run into tens of millions of dollars.
And sometimes it costs next to nothing to monitor a fire in the remote wilderness. But more and more people are moving to the woods, so oftentimes fire managers draw a map. And on one side, they suppress a blaze where there's a community nearby, and on the other side, they may let it burn into a rocky ridge where it puts itself out. In Flagstaff, I'm Laurel Morales for Marketplace.
Action could come in Congress this week on one piece of stalled legislation, the highway bill. But there are some questions now about how to spend portions of the $100 billion in states that have turned toll roads over to private companies. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
I'm standing on New York Avenue in downtown Washington. It becomes Route 50 when it leaves the city. 50 goes across the country. Let's say a state decided to privatize part of 50. Under the new Senate highway bill, it could lose some federal funding. That's because of a Senate amendment. Federal highway funding is based in part on how many miles of roads a state has. The amendment wouldn't let states count privatized toll roads. The thinking is federal highway funds shouldn't be used to maintain private pavement. Joshua Shank doesn't buy that. He heads the Eno Center for Transportation in Washington.
I see this as just finding a way to pick away at their money and not really a smart philosophical argument.
Shank says federal money is never used to maintain toll roads, public or private. The toll money goes toward repairs. Shank says members of Congress are trying to get more scarce highway money for their states. And if another state loses out, so be it. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
Tomorrow, Wisconsin voters decide whether to recall their governor. Republican Scott Walker has curbed public employee union rights and benefits, and the campaign is being fueled by lots of corporate money in support of the governor and lots of union money in support of his recall. Fortune magazine senior editor-at-large Alan Sloan sees Wisconsin in a national context. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, David.
So we have this economy that, no one argues with this, needs a stronger middle class, but American voters seem divided on the role that unions play in providing that.
Well, sure, especially public employee unions, where taxpayers like me and even like you have not had a great time the last few years. And you look around at public employees and you say, wait a minute, I don't have what I used to have. I have to give up a lot. They should give up something, too. And that's, in many ways, the genesis of this.
But we're talking about teachers, firefighters, policemen putting their lives on the line. Curbing their benefits is a tough sell.
Well, it is a tough sell, and it's not like I'm thrilled to do it. But if you look around, especially in New Jersey, where you and I both live, for years and years and years, the unions in New Jersey did extremely well to the point where the state just couldn't afford the benefits. And you now end up with Chris Christie,
the governor of the state now, who has made it his mission to curb the amount of money that public sector workers get in terms of compensation and benefits. But you see this as almost on a continuum, like the pendulum has swung.
Right. Exactly so. Up until a few years ago, public unions, at least in many states, seemed unstoppable. They were organized. They were smart. And then comes the Great Recession. And suddenly these unions are vulnerable politically and financially. But it took some of them quite a while to figure it out.
Well, in places like Wisconsin and places like New Jersey, those public sector unions have, in fact, had to allow the cutbacks.
Right. Indeed, they have. And the huge difference between New Jersey and Wisconsin and some of the other states, in New Jersey, the benefits have been curbed, but the right to unionize is still there. The thing that shocked me in Wisconsin, which I used to think of as a progressive state, was when they took the bargaining ability away. I didn't even know you could do that, but that shows how little I know.
Alan Sloan, senior editor-at-large, Fortune Magazine. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, David.
How young is too young to be on Facebook? In order to increase its reach, there's word that Facebook is now developing a system that would allow kids under the age of 13 to play games and use the social network. Until now, that age group has been barred from the site. Child advocates and some psychologists are raising some privacy and some developmental concerns.
Here to talk with us in our Midday Extra is Dr. John Grohol, a psychologist and editor-in-chief of Psych Central. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, Dr. Grohol, first, give us your initial reaction to this news.
Well, I think Facebook is just answering the reality that today there are a lot of pre-13-year-olds who are using the website, and they would like to better understand and make sure that they can monitor that usage and have parents have the tools to monitor that usage.
Now, from your perspective as a person with skills in psychology, are there concerns here, or do you think they can pull this off without endangering any kids?
Well, one of the challenges is that there hasn't been a whole lot of research done to date on teenagers using Facebook and whether that impacts the quality of their lives or if it makes them more difficult to gain social skills, things like that. Even worse is because Facebook technically does not allow children younger than 13 on the site today, researchers haven't really been able to study this group and to say whether it's going to be a positive or a negative thing.
So we really have no idea. We don't know who's using it, how many of these under 13s are using it already, and what the effect on them is.
Yeah, we do have some data, and the little data that we have in this area suggests that basically people who may already have low self-esteem or have problems with being sociable with other teens are more drawn to using Facebook, and that's not surprising because it's a great tool to use when you may not have the ability to interact with people face-to-face very well.
Now, as a man of science, you may not appreciate anecdotal information, but I was talking to some teachers. Now, this wasn't quite in the age group in question here. This is just a little older, high school. And they've been noticing, these teachers, a sort of compulsion that a lot of their students have to constantly need to check Facebook and their other social media, constant updates where they sort of feel like something's wrong. And you worry about that developing into a problem.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a term for that. It's called fear of missing out, FOMO. And it affects just not teens and kids, but it also affects adults who have the same kind of problem where they check Facebook and they check other social media because they're fearful that something is going on that they're not aware of and they don't know about it. Everybody else knows about it, but they don't.
I think just about every journalist has a FOMO then because it's a constant. Every time I wake up from a nap, I check my email immediately. Let me ask you one more thing, Doctor, which is how does Facebook use compare to, these kids under 13 using video games or watching a ton of TV or anything like that?
People seem to be using Facebook really to sort of carry on the conversation that they're already having with their real-life face-to-face friends. So it's sort of how people 20 or 30 years ago used the telephone. They get on the phone and spend hours every day talking to their friends on the phone, the same friends that they just saw in school.
Psychologist John Grohol is editor-in-chief of Psych Central. Thank you very much.
You betcha.
Tomorrow, the Dallas-based pizza chain Pizza Patron is giving away free pizzas to customers who order in Spanish. That plan has drawn some criticism, but as our wealth and poverty reporter Shireen Marisol Meraji tells us, the restaurant sees the gimmick as part of its mission to focus on the Hispanic community.
Antonio Suad left the Midwest for the Southwest 26 years ago.
Yeah, Midwestern boy, grew up in Columbus, Ohio. So, you know, I came to Dallas, Texas to sort of pursue my dream of being in business for myself.
And with $11,000, he started a pizzeria called Pizza Pizza in a neighborhood he knew nothing about.
It was sort of news to me that I was in probably the second largest Hispanic community in the Dallas Metroplex.
Don't be fooled by his name. Antonio Suad is not Hispanic. His roots are Lebanese and Italian. So he hired bilingual employees.
Changed the name to Pizza Patron.
And has been focused on the Hispanic consumer ever since.
Hola, bienvenido. ¿Cómo le puedo ayudar?
Today, there are more than 100 Pizza Patrons in 7 states. This one's in Los Angeles. Olivia Barba opened it with her husband a year and a half ago. Barba says there are strict rules to be a Pizza Patron franchisee.
We do have to have bilingual employees.
The store has to be in a majority Latino area or one headed there soon. Store managers must live in the neighborhood, and the owners have to get the Hispanic community.
My parents are Mexican descent. His parents are from El Salvador. And then we have a partner as well. They're Mexican and from Guatemala.
Marketing expert Juan Tornoe says brands hungry to capture the Latino market should look to Pizza Patron and ignore brands like Purina, the dog food company advertising a fiesta flavor.
And they're saying how this food has all these Latino elements that will get your dog in the party mood. It's like, really?
Tornoe says Pizza Patron focuses on the Hispanic market without patronizing, and that's why it works. He adds that he just might take part in tomorrow's free pizza offer.
I'm going to say, quiero pizza, por favor, and I'm going to get a free pizza for my mom. She'll get a kick out of it.
I'm Shireen Marisol Meraji for Marketplace.
American Apparel. The struggling company's big thing is that it makes its apparel in America. Now the company's controversial CEO says he's under pressure to start importing. Dov Charney tells the LA Times he hasn't caved yet, but he can't rule out moving some manufacturing abroad.
You know, David, every time I would drive past the American Apparel in Malibu, I always wondered two things. One, do they really make their apparel all in downtown Los Angeles, which apparently I guess they do. And number two, no wonder this company's in trouble if they're building their stores right on the coast of the PCH in Malibu.
Yeah, an expensive area. Well, they're working on some of this.
Well, finally, to some thoughts on retirement from the former head of the bailed-out insurance giant AIG. Robert Ben Moshe told Bloomberg News that going forward, people may have to work until they're 80 to cut down on public pension costs. Now, Mr. Ben Moshe is 68, and he made those comments, David, from Croatia, where he was relaxing at his seaside villa.
Well, he needs his rest if he's going to work till he's 80 or 90.
In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm David Brancaccio. You've been listening to the Marketplace Midday Update. On APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.